Welcome, Loveland sports fans, to another edition of the Loveland Magazine Sports Podcast. It's Thursday, June 28th, another lovely day, and I'm here with my co-host, Mark Raines. How we doing, Mark?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm glad we do a sports podcast instead of a podcast about geriatric politicians. So excited to get going today.
You know, I used to talk about politics, but you schooled me too many times, so now I just stick to sports. And once again, you're schooling me in sports, so maybe I should just take away a nice lesson from that.
Well, let's have some fun today.
All right. Well, it's always better to talk sports after a win for the Reds. That's what we got last night, 11-4 against the Cardinals. Big stories in that game, obviously 11 runs, which is kind of a nice change of pace for the Reds offense, but the return of Noelvi Marte playing third base from suspension, picking up three hits last night, also three runs. Jonathan India staying strong as well, two more hits, extra bases as well for him. So nice win for the Reds, and boy, Mark, you talk about cherry picking stats. If the Reds only had to play game one of every series, I think they'd be in the World Series.
Well, it's great to get game one, especially against the Cardinals, who, let's face it, nobody likes. So, good to see. And Jonathan India, man, continues to just hit the hell out of the ball this month.
Yeah, and we were going to talk about this a little later, but you brought up a good point. All-star voting's coming up very soon, and I mean, I thought in my own personal mind that Ellie De La Cruz was going to be kind of the no-brainer shot, but I mean, Jonathan India is making a case, isn't he?
Yeah, especially this month. I mean, I think I was going through everything, and I felt even when I started preparing for it earlier this week that De La Cruz was really the only option when I was looking at things. But India is really coming on strong. Just looking at his June splits, I mean, he's hitting 375 in June, 453 on base percentage. You know, his slugging's been down this year, which has been a big thing, but in this month, it's not. He's slugging too, 4.563. So I mean, he is just having a great stretch of baseball right now.
And I, you know, the Reds at times when they've scored or struggled to score runs, I guess I should say, he's getting on base. And he was on base 11 straight times. You know, at one point he got on base two more times last night. I mean, and when you're struggling offensively, if you get base runners like that on a consistent basis, it's just you're giving your team a chance to score, and that's something the Reds desperately need.
Yeah, desperately. And you know, he's at the top of the order type guy, you know, early in the lineup, set things up for the guys down the road. And he is really performing this month. I mean, he won Rookie of the Year, didn't he? Sometimes my mind blanks on these things a couple years ago.
He did. And I was looking at his numbers, you know, like you said, and that rookie season, they were some of the highest in terms of some of the sabermetric statistics, but he's inching his way back towards that. And you know, this was a guy that a lot of Reds fans wanted traded, and wanted didn't, you know, ha care to have him back on the team. And you know, look at what he's doing now, and you can't predict anything, obviously, but the way he started off the season was not the best, but it's a sustained period of success, I think, at this point, the way he's hitting, and I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to slash 375, 563, the rest of the way. That's impossible. I think this month his batting average on balls in play is 475. So, you know, he's getting a little lucky with those numbers, but he's still drawing walks. He's still having really good at bats. And so he's going to be a guy who gets on base, which people don't, and I know we're going to talk about this a little later. I sent you an article, and I don't want to get into it too quickly, but people don't get on base now like they used to, and a lot of it's because of the pitching. And he's a guy that can, and you need that in your lineup at the top of the order.
And I think part of it too, we're going to talk about this as well, is, you know, what's holding the Reds back? And not to take it to a negative space, but again, they are, you know, they're five games under 500 here, and they haven't won a series in quite some time. And the reasons for that, I think we want to talk about. And one thing I wanted to point out was the injuries to start off with. And they're not devastating injuries. Because if you take a look at the Braves especially and who they're missing, Spencer Strider, Cy Young candidate at least, out for the year with elbow surgery. Ronald Acuna Jr., done for the year, torn ACL. Just look at the list of injuries, and I'll put a link to it on the webpage when we post the article. But, I mean, they're still playing extremely well. And the contrast to that is the Reds. I mean, the Reds haven't, apart from guys like CES, who's out for the year, McLain, who was out for a large chunk of time, it's just these nagging injuries that really are dragging this team down, because there's been guys that we've talked about that have gotten hot for different periods of time. India's one of them. Friedel's one of them. Steer early on. And I just feel, this is my own personal thought, that they can't all be hot at the same time. But if they just stayed healthy for consistent periods of time and you have rotations of guys getting hot or playing well, this team could have a lot more opportunity, and they just don't get a chance to do that because there's so many of these nagging injuries.
Well, and it's baseball, and they're not a very – I don't think they're a particularly deep team. I think they're already kind of, especially with their lineup, a team that really is dependent on having all those guys healthy, because they're not going to be a top-of-the-league hitting team anyways. So when you start losing a couple guys, now all of a sudden you're a bad hitting team. And so I they're just, I don't think they're, I think they're a 500, I think they're a 70 to 80 win team, frankly. And I thought that for a while, and they got hot, and that was good. And I remember asking you a couple weeks ago, you know, was it, are they, is this how it's going to go? Or is this just kind of the ebbs and flows of the baseball season? I think it's a 70 to 80 type win team. I don't think they're a team that's going to win the division, but you know, if the lineup's healthy, the pitching at the top has been pretty good. So, you know, you always can hope.
Right. And you know, Hunter Green threw up on the mound for the second time in as many starts a couple nights ago, which was kind of a great just bullet point for how that game went overall. Andrew Abbott last night, it seems to be a consistent point for him. He has to battle. He had six walks, you know, through his first couple innings, and he got the win, ended up only giving two earned runs in five innings. So I think the pitching is there, and they don't make it easy on themselves, that's for sure. But in terms of 70 to 80 wins, I don't disagree with you there. It's just, you know, my problem is it's not statistics-based. It's kind of a gut reaction. You see games like last night, you know, game one of the series, last series against the Pirates, where you're seeing runs just come across the board in droves, and it makes you think that this team is capable of at least something like that on a more sustained basis. And the fact of the matter is, you know, like you said, with the lineup how it is and the bench how short it is, that just may not be the case over the long term.
Do we have an idea on the timeline for Nick Lodolo coming back? Because, I mean, he's been fabulous this season. His numbers are excellent. He's done it efficiently when he's on the mound. But you know, 15 day, it looks like he put on the 15 day injury list. Are we expecting him to be back after that? What do we know about that?
And I do believe it was retroactive to a certain date. And I had read a few tweets and some articles that indicated July 9th was his projected return, which, you know, is good to hear. I try to be as active as I can in the social media world, but just, you know, do yourself a favor sometimes and lay off Facebook, because the amount of people complaining about how he's out because of a quote unquote blister and calling him, you know, weak and weak willed. I mean, these people have obviously never pitched a day in their life. They don't know how important it is to grip a baseball when you're throwing 96, 97 miles an hour and trying to get a spin on the ball. So, I mean, it's a serious thing.
One less than 160. I mean, six games. This starts so that he has his best stuff. There's no reason for him to gut through it right now. Get healthy on that hand. Like that's silly.
Yeah, it's you know, it's Facebook. It is what it is. It's a, you know, it's an analysis. Everyone's entitled to their opinion, but you got to think it through a little bit when you're talking about an injury like that. So, a couple other things, I since you mentioned pitching, Graham Ashcraft came back from the minors. He was sent there to obviously work on some of the issues that he was having. I was hopeful that it would go a little bit better than it did. It did not. He was knocked around all over the place, and I don't know what his future is, to be honest. He was given a chance, and it just didn't work out, so I'm not sure what to expect in him in the future. I'd like to see him maybe see what he could do in the bullpen if necessary, but I think his days as an impact starter for the Reds may be dwindling down.
Yeah, he's 26 years now. He has better from his before season, which wasn't particularly good anyways. It's things you're hoping he can build on. He's at best a back of the rotation starter, and I really don't think he's that. I think he's a guy who can, you know, you seems like a AAA type player to me. I have a better answer in the back of the rotation, but I don't really think he's it.
Yeah. Well, and I thought at times he had stuff that was, you know, could be not dominant, but I think it could have been, you know, above average in the league. But based on what we're seeing, I'm not sure that that's ever going to come to fruition, but time will tell. And since we're on pitching, Mark, you sent me an Athletic article. I'll also put that in the article that we post when the podcast is done. But do you want to take the folks through that a little bit and what the premise of that article is as it relates to pitching in this era of the Major League Baseball?
Well, yeah, I found it fascinating, and because you hear a lot of complaints about guys not putting the ball in play anymore, and batting averages are way down, and a lot of the theories you hear out there are everyone's just swinging for the fences, right? Everyone's, you know, no one goes opposite field, no one is trying to just hit for contact, but I think what I found fascinating, and I think this is really accurate, is I think the bigger issue in hitting and why averages are so down is there's been a recontextualizing of baseball with pitchers, and pitchers are pitching to strike out guys. That's what they're doing now. They don't want you to put the ball in play. They don't want you to hit the ball, and everyone's doing it. So there's guys are throwing a lot harder. There's a focus on throwing harder. There's a focus on throwing with more spin. And so they're causing a lot more swings and misses. And it's also why you see a lot of like shorter innings now, and a lot, you just have more pitchers that can go out there and throw hard for a short period of time. Trust your bullpen to do that, to get you those outs, to pitch for a few strikeouts. And so I found it fascinating. It's really long. I mean, it's really detailed. It's going to take you a long read to read it, but I really do think that's the issue. And you look at a guy like, bringing it back to Jonathan India, I think is a good way to relate it. His hitting, you know, his for the season, his hitting numbers are great. 272 batting average right now with the way pitching is excellent when you're walking too, getting on, and he's walking too, so he's getting on base at a 378 clip. Like, that's hard to do in this day and age. And it's not because you don't have really talented hitters. It's not because these guys are just swinging for the fences. It's just a refocus on how pitchers pitch now. And I do think at some level that's less fun for the fans, right? I'd much rather have the ball in play, and I'd much rather, you know, see fielding and not see strikeouts. And you get more frustrated when your guys are striking out with guys with runners in scoring position. But I just think that's the game now. And I don't think it's the fault of anyone. It's people have figured out that that's the best way to keep runs off the board.
Right. And I think in baseball, we tend to talk about these epochal events, the live ball era, the dead ball era, you know, these sorts of terms get thrown around a lot. And, you know, who knows what they may name this, you know, era eventually. But what I thought was interesting was the way that they were contrasting kind of the size of these pitchers. You know, I remember back when, you know, Randy Johnson was in the league, you know, speaking about how tall he was and his arm angle and the way he was throwing the ball so hard. I mean, and then you look at this era, you've got guys like Skeens and Kershaw, just giant individuals, pitchers that 6'5", 6'6". I mean, even Nick Lodolo is quite tall as well. And you're seeing just a different type of pitcher being run out there on the mound that, again, Mark Pryor, I like the quote in there. He's like, you know, I learned that I had to go out and I'm going to try to strike out the side in the first to, you know, send a message and to get those swings and misses. So I think it's interesting how baseball is progressing. And it's almost like if you were to see in football, you know, some sort of rule change that took the emphasis off the offensive side of the ball and you were seeing games that were 9-6, you know, 6-3. I mean, the low scoring games, it does have an impact on how fans view the game. And unless you're just a pitching connoisseur, I guess, but you have to at least admire the the way that the game has evolved and that and just how dominant these pitchers can be. And we talked about Skeens the other day and how young he is. I mean, it's the future. It just is.
Yeah, and you make a great point on the size of these guys. I think that really comes to the fact that they've really changed what they're looking for in pitchers at all levels, and it's starting very young. And so I think a lot of these big guys that might they might not necessarily put on the mound, right? They might have them, you know, just focusing on their hitting and playing it and playing in the field, and they don't necessarily bring them up as pitchers. But these are the guys with the frames to throw 99. 100 miles an hour. These are the guys that can really have difficult angles for the hitters to see the ball and can get more spin. So I think there's a focus even at the lowest levels on finding these just like physical freaks and physical talents and turning them into these supercharged pitchers that can just gas the ball. And it starts at the low level. And so now you're seeing at the professional level, these hitters are having trouble hitting the ball because these guys are pitching to strike you out and they're throwing harder than ever and they're throwing with more spin than ever. And it's just much harder to hit the ball now than it ever was.
Right. And I think, you know, looking back on, you know, I'm not an encyclopedia of baseball knowledge, but you have kind of this repertoire of great pitchers that threw hard, you know, the Nolan Ryans of the world and the Randy Johnsons. And, but I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but in large part in my memory, you know, the guys that threw 100 miles an hour were the closers that came in and they poured it all in there for three outs. Now, taking that intensity, I mean, I keep coming back to him, but Paul Skeens was throwing 100 miles an hour in the sixth inning. I mean, this is six innings of guys throwing triple digits and then throwing breaking balls that can just buckle you. I mean, it's entirely a new era, I think, of pitching, and it's just wild to see what they can do.
It's different physical talents, and it's different training, and it's different focus from very young. And also, we've seen some consequences of it with a lot more arm injuries, too. I mean, it's like it's not come without a cost. Like there, a lot of these guys have big arm injuries within a couple years of being in the majors. So there is downside to it, obviously. But these guys are, you know, incredible. And they really focus on getting swings and misses. And that's making it really hard for hitters. It's probably making baseball a little more boring for people than it used to be, because you like to see people put the ball in play.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly an interesting article, and I'll be sure to post the link. Is there anything else you wanted to say on that, the article there, Mark, before we move on to the next section?
No, I just thought it was fascinating, and I thought it could add some context to what we watched with the Reds, so I appreciate talking about that today.
Yeah, no, it's a great article, and I learned a lot, and it's a lot of statistics-based stuff, which is always good to have it based off of that, so... All right. As people probably know about me, I'm a big Cavaliers fan. It's Ohio's only pro basketball team, so I love to talk about it. And it's a big, big week for the Cavaliers. So obviously firing J.B. Bickerstaff after last season's run and then their eventual loss in the playoffs to the Boston Celtics. Kenny Atkinson was signed to a five-year contract this week. Kenny Atkinson, you may remember, had a good run with the New York or Brooklyn Nets, I should say. And he really improved them. I mean, they were a terrible team. In just 2 years, he took them from a 20-win team to a playoff team in the Eastern Conference. And then the Durant and Irving era began for Brooklyn, and it was just not pretty in any sense of the imagination for anyone that was involved in that. He resigned from that position, and then recently he's been an assistant for the Golden State Warriors. So, and the question, you know, that I have is that I'm interested to see is the Cavaliers aren't in a position for a rebuild, Mark, but they are looking for a guy to get them over the top. And, you know, my question that I hope to get an answer to is he that guy? And I don't know how much Cavaliers basketball you've watched, but you're a good NBA guy and a great basketball mind, and you know how tough the Eastern Conference is. Does this, you know, move the needle for you at all in any way, or what do you think?
Well, first, other than Boston, I think the Eastern Conference has an opening. I think there's some good teams, but not like great teams behind Boston. So Cavs are right there and have the opportunity to play themselves in to be the second best team in the conference. And who knows what happens at that point. I think Kenny Atkinson did not get a fair shake in New Jersey or in Brooklyn. I think he seems like a pretty good coach, and his track record suggests he's a very good coach. He's been at Golden State, I believe, for a few years now. I think he's going to be good, and I think the Cavs have the talent to be good. And here's where the what the Cavs lack, and pretty much when a lot of teams lack, and honestly, I think Boston even lacked, is that generational talent. Now, Boston has a top 10 type guy, borderline top 5 type guy, and a top, 20 type guy in the league. So they have they made up for it with depth of talent. And I think that's kind of what the Cavs have to do. The Cavs have some really good players. They've got a top 15 type guy, 15 to 20 type guy. They've got a couple top 40 type guys that you hope continue to progress. If they can find depth of talent, and I think they can be pretty successful. Stay healthy. Really, Mobley's development is to me the biggest key for them, though. I mean, if he can take a big jump for them, that's going to put them in that upper echelon in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. And it's kind of an unfair question, I guess, to see how is Kenny Atkinson going to do, because there's other dominoes to fall, and the first one's obviously Donovan Mitchell's extension and getting that done and what that looks like, and him being there obviously. But the temperature around the league, I think, is that Donovan Mitchell is going to sign the extension with the Cavaliers, and I hope that happens. And then a domino right after that is what's Darius Garland going to do? His representatives have been, very vocal that he would, like a trade, but he hasn't come out and said anything himself necessarily. Roster construction, as we talked about, it's going to be a big issue because the Cavaliers have a lot of positional overlap in terms of Garland and Mitchell both being undersized, and then Mobley and Allen not being able to play necessarily to each other's strengths because they clog the lane a lot. And I think what you saw in the last game against Boston with Mobley, especially, he was facing the basket a lot more. He was dribbling a bit. He was backing, away from the rim. And I think if you can see more of that Mobley, to your point, developing him in that way, it frees up a lot of that lane space for, Jared Allen to be successful. So if the Cavaliers have that same core back, I think they could do a good job of playing together and playing each other's strengths and improving that spacing. And I think part of the Mitchell Garland dynamic is the offense that Kenny Atkinson's going to run. You're going to run fast, you're going to run hard, you're going to chuck threes. And I think the Cavaliers have the bodies to do that more so than what they did under J.B. Bickerstaff, where he liked to slow it down a little bit and kind of run that half-court offense some more. If you have two undersized guards that are running and gunning a bit, I think it gives you just a little bit more flexibility. And so I think that roster construction can work. Now, is it going to be that? I don't know. I think time will tell. But Garland has that talent, and I just want him to show it on the court a little bit. And he hasn't. His numbers are good, but just the feel of it when he's on the court and his ability to take over in times when Mitchell hasn't had his game or others have been struggling, it just wasn't there last season, unfortunately.
So when I look at Garland, I think of somebody like Conley, from Memphis. I mean, not Memphis anymore now. He was in Minnesota last year, but in his Memphis days, I think that's kind of the ceiling for a guy like Garland. I don't think he's like a top of the league type point guard, but I think he's a really good point guard. And he's good to have it. I think you're right to have some concerns regarding the size of the two small guards. But they also have, pretty good defensive bigs that can make up for it. So they don't have the switchability. They have small guards that can probably be attacked by certain teams. So I think that's where having those multiple bigs that are athletic that can recover and help is a big thing for them. It's hard for me to say what they really need. I don't maybe a little more shooting. I like do like the idea of them running a little more. Because I do think with those small guards, that does make sense. I think you're onto something there. They're kind of right on that border for me of a team that, that is not quite there, doesn't quite have enough to compete for the tit for a title. But they're pretty good. Middle of the Eastern Conference team that maybe if with the right development from these guys can make a jump to be a top two or three team in the conference.
And you talk about development. The draft, NBA draft, was this week. We'll talk a little bit about that. Cavs first round draft pick, Jalen Tyson. small forward out of Cal. 6'6", 218, his measurables there for the Golden Bears. He averaged almost 20 points per game, almost 7 rebounds, and then 3.5 assists last year. Shot over 46% from the field, 36% from three. So the Cavaliers have a interesting, I guess I'll say, philosophy when it comes to their small forwards. They drafted Isaac Okoro several years ago, a defensive first player. They knew that coming out of college. They were hoping they could progress his offensive game to a point where it would be maybe not on par with his defensive ability, but at least somewhat serviceable in the NBA. And I don't think that's happened necessarily. His offensive game's been there at times. He's shot well from three on certain occasions, but he's disappeared for long stretches of the time. But he can guard almost any position on the floor with a pretty great efficiency, and that's something that you definitely need from your wing spot. But Jalen Tyson gives you something else. He can create his own shot. As you see, I wrote an article about this for the magazine, and check it out, some of his highlights. He's got great ability to get open, to create his own shot, and to attack the rim. He does have some issues handling the ball. Won't deny that. But if you're going to try to fill a gap in the Cavaliers lineup, someone who can create their own shot at a forward position that's not Darius Garland or Donovan Mitchell, I think eventually he will check that box. 6'6 is a bit short. He played guard, and basically he was Cal's point guard for his time there because they were so bad and they didn't really have a true point guard. So I think he's going to be asked to play the small forward position for the Cavs, and that's a tough kind of height to deal with. But I think his athleticism is going to give him a lot of space to try to create something. And if you're going to run, once again, Isaac Okoro, maybe not the man for that and in Kenny Atkinson's system, but I think that Jalen Tyson can be that person.
Yeah, I have no idea. There's a lot of college basketball players I'm going to have opinions on because I watch a lot of college basketball. I got to frank with you, I didn't watch it any Cal. They were 13-19 this year. They didn't, you know, I think Mattson's going to do a good job at Cal, Mark Mattson, but they weren't there this year. From looking at the KenPom stuff on him, he had a decent assist rate. For a point guard, it's not great, but, you know, he's not really a true point guard. So I think a pretty good assist rate. Turnover rate was fine. He drew a good amount of fouls, which you want to see from a guy his size. You want to see a guy get the line. Honestly, I'd probably like to see him get to line a little more than he did, it looks like, but he did a decent job drawing fouls. So I don't know. I have no idea what to expect from this guy. I don't know what his upside is. I have a hard time projecting NBA guys in general. And then, you know, someone I didn't watch at all, it's hard for me to make any intelligent comments on.
I think part of it too was Cavaliers fans were not quite as happy because he wasn't necessarily projected as a first round pick. And I think the Cavaliers saw someone they needed that could fill a spot that they needed filled in terms of his athletic ability. And it may end up being a reach. I mean, people thought Isaac Okoro was a reach too. So I guess time will tell at the end, but another interesting point where time will definitely tell is Bronny James. And I was at dinner last night watching the TV at a sports bar when I saw it come through. Mark, what do you think about the Lakers going with Bronny?
Okay, I'm going to have the weird controversial take on this that no one seems to have. I'm fine with it. It's a second-round draft pick. It's the 55th pick out of, 58 picks in the NBA draft, something like that. You're taking a chance on a guy who's probably not going to make it in the league when you get to that point in the draft. And so you're going to bet on something. And in this case, they're betting on his athletic talent and they're betting on his pedigree. And one of the things you look at time and time again on studies of development, pedigree is a good predictor of a guy's ability to develop into something. So I think if you're making a bet on a guy, it's not a bad bet to make. They already have his dad anyways. So I was completely fine with the taking a shot on Bronny. I know people are pointing at his like college numbers. I think there's a lot of grain of salt to take with his college numbers. One, he, you know, had that heart issue right before the season, right? He didn't have his full training, wasn't ready to go. We didn't even know if he was going to play. And then he did a lot of little things well while he played. He was a good passer. He was a good defensive player. He was in the passing lane. So I don't think he's ready. I don't think he's probably going to play much. And I think in all likelihood, he's not going to end up being an NBA player because most second round guys are not going to end up being NBA players within a few years. But if you're betting on somebody, it's not a bad bet late in the second round to take a bet on pedigree.
Now, do you think, Mark, and this is maybe my ignorance, but do you think LeBron would have left the Lakers if they did not draft Bronny?
No, I don't. And I don't think it's necessarily that he'll stay because they did draft him. He'll be there this year. But who knows what's going to happen, next season. I don't know what's going through LeBron's head. I don't think it's really going to have much to do. If Bronny suddenly like develops quickly, right, and is able to stay on the roster and contribute, maybe that will cause him to just stick around and play a couple more years in LA. That's definitely possible, and maybe that's something in the back of their heads. But I don't think, if he doesn't make it or, he's not ready yet and he's playing a lot, he's playing in the what is it, NBA DL, if he's playing, not playing on the roster as like maybe a two-way contract, those kind of things. There's so much that goes into it. I don't think LeBron was going to make his decision based on that.
Now, do you think, if you could put a percentage on it, is there a percentage chance that you think that LeBron James and Bronny James play 1 minute together in a Laker uniform in an NBA basketball game? Is there a
I think that's
percentage?
probably about 100%.
Okay.
I think it's going to happen. Even if Bronny's not quite there, I think he'll be on the roster at least for a little bit. And they'll and when he, if he's on the roster, they'll get him into a game with LeBron. I it's bound to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, again, second round picks, apart from, I think, was it Jokic, a second round pick? I mean,
You can find a guy. You're betting on something, right? You're taking a chance on it. And there have been a lot of guys that have turned into exceptional guys from the second round. It's just the vast majority don't end up playing in the league very long.
right, and I guess so. The kind of jumping off a cliff opinion that this second round pick is some sort of dumpster fire nepotism bet doesn't necessarily track with, second round picks are picks where you take a flyer on a guy sometime, and why not take a flyer on this, right?
It's definitely nepotism, but it's also like pedigree is a thing that is measurable, that we've looked at, that there's been studies on, that pedigree is a good thing when you look for like development and what the likelihood of a guy of developing beyond what he is. So if you're betting on something, betting on pedigree is not a bad bet, even if the guy ultimately doesn't end up making it.
All right, well, it was a pretty good wrap up this week. Try to keep it tight here, and we got some more topics to hit on the next time we're together. Not sure when that's going to be, with 4th of July being next week, but Mark, you got any big 4th of July plans to tell the folks about?
Not that I know of. I'm sure something will come up. Taking the rare day off work, which will be nice. But hopefully we'll get some more Bearcat topics next week and be back on board. And
All right. Well, looking forward to that. If we obviously July 4th next Thursday, but I hope everyone has a lovely holiday. If you're taking the week off, maybe boating or doing something outside, be safe. And as always, bring us your takes on sports at the Facebook page, or the comments section, wherever that may be. Just wanted a little plug here. We did start a Loveland Sports Desk, which is a Facebook page, also a Twitter page and Instagram. You can head on over to Loveland Magazine to hear more about that, where we'll post some of our smaller updates at, as games go on. If you want to chat maybe in game or talk back and forth as you're watching a Reds game, when the Bengals come around, Bearcats, whatever it may be, we'll be monitoring those to be responsive. Love to have our sports conversation there. But for now, I want to say thanks to Mark, and thank you to all our listeners out there, and be well, everyone.